I'm delighted to be back in your pulpit this early spring Sunday. The snow might not have melted. Ice crystals may still be assaulting us from the sky. But this morning I can bring you the good news that the days are at least getting longer. The first flowers are coming. And on such a day, I'm happy to be with you again. It's a treat to worship with my dear friend David Park, and a privilege to stand before the congregation to which Theodore Parker used to preach. This morning, I bring you a reflective sermon centered on poetry. Now, haiku was the first form of poetry I learned. I encountered it in elementary school in the fourth grade. One of my teachers taught us to write the simple form. It was an exercise designed to help us learn syllables. Three lines, first line, five syllables, second line, seven syllables, third line, five syllables. No rhyming necessary. I have no clear memory of my first haiku. I doubt it was particularly sophisticated. Most likely it was a concrete pile of images sparked by something simple I observed on my daily walk to and from school. Blue jays fly overhead. Green tree leaves are everywhere I go. It wasn't until I was in college that I realized that the haiku was a serious literary form. I engaged with it through beat poets like Jack Kerouac and Gary Snyder. A lot of their haikus weren't even proper haikus. They captured the essence of the form rather than following it precisely. What I noticed reading them is that the haiku could be more than just a series of images. Instead, it could contain a compressed narrative, like this selection from Gary Snyder's Hitch Haiku. They didn't hire him. So he ate his lunch alone. The noon whistles. There's more packed into that little poem than can be found in a lot of sermons. It offers many questions and few answers. Why didn't they hire him? Who was he? Where did he eat his lunch? Reading the poem, I picture a grizzled old itinerant worker in dungarees, sitting on a large flat stone, sun shining over his head in a small woodland clearing behind a factory. I imagine the kind of factories I used to discover rambling through Detroit and Chicago. Brick, half crumbled, pressed up against a spot of vacant industrial land slowly being reclaimed by the wilderness. It was from the beats that I eventually made my way to the Japanese haiku masters. I loved Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and someone told me it was inspired by the Japanese poet's Matsu Basho's poem, The Narrow Road to the Interior. Basho was one of the greatest writers of haiku. He composed what is the most famous work in the form. Breaking the silence of an ancient pond, a frog jumped into water, a deep resonance. Numerous commentaries exist on this text. Most observe that Basho was a Zen Buddhist. For him, the pond was a metaphor for the mind. When the water is clear and still, it is like the mind when it is enlightened. Undisturbed, the reflections on the surface are just reflections of the images of objects, not the objects themselves. The actual objects exist outside of the pond, just as everything we perceive exists outside of our minds. Any motion on the pond is produced by external factors. Waves come when the wind riles up the surface. They disappear when the wind dies down. Ripples emerge when an object pierces the water's calm top. they too fade quickly. In the poem, the frog can be understood as a thought. It appears from nowhere, troubles the water with its splash, leaves behind a disappearing sound, and then goes under the surface. Perhaps it will reappear again, frog eyes sticking up through duckweed and scheming their next step. The poem's popularity and such interpretations have led to parodies. Here's one by Gibbon Sengai. The old pond, Basho jumps in, the sound of water. Haikus like these were presented either alone or as part of a series of interlinking poems. These contained somewhere between 200 and a few hundred haiku. Some of them were authored by a single poet. Others were written by many working together collaboratively. One of my favorite pieces attributed to Basho, thus, might not have even been original to him. It appears in one of his texts as composed by a priest who traveled with him. Regardless of the weather, the moon shines the same. It is the drifting clouds that make it seem different on different nights. This piece, like many of Basho's haikus, appears in one of his travel sketches, the series of texts which include the narrow road to the interior, narrate some of his travels around Japan in the late 17th century. They alternate, as I have been doing in my sermon, between narrative descriptions, philosophical reflection, and poetry. They describe Basho's journey as pilgrimages. Pilgrimages are a kind of intentional journey undertaken with some sort of spiritual purpose in mind. Ultimately, usually when we think of pilgrimages, we think of traveling to a specific destination. In the Christian tradition, for instance, people have long made pilgrimages to Jerusalem, to the sites of the miracles and to the tombs of various saints. On such pilgrimages, the journey is completed when the destination is reached. Sometimes the object being traveled to is thought of having supernatural powers that grant a blessing on the pilgrim. This blessing may be a healing that comes in this life, or cleansing of sins that leads to a better afterlife. Basho's pilgrimage was of a different sort. Instead of seeking a particular destination, he sought to travel for self-discovery. Within this pilgrimage, there is usually a kind of recognition that life itself is a journey. As Basho writes in The Narrow Road to the Interior, days and months are travelers of eternity. So are the years that pass by. Those who steer a boat across the sea or drive a horse over the earth till they succumb to the weight of years spend every minute of their lives traveling. Within these sentences is the acknowledgement that to be human and to be alive is to be in motion. Think about it. We spend much of our lives traveling, whether it is from home to work and back again, or to some distant city to visit friends and relatives. Our lives are filled with travel. Some days, it seems like all I do is move. Saturday, I went to the gym, rushed home to shuttle my daughter off to her boyfriend's, took my son to get a birthday present for his friend, then took him to a birthday party, and then went to the pharmacy and two different grocery stores. Sound familiar? I imagine it does. Even though when we are not navigating our way through lives, we still are in motion. The Earth spins on its axis and orbits the sun. The sun, in turn, circles the center of the Milky Way. The Milky Way rushes out from the origin of the Big Bang as the universe expands. On a smaller scale, the atoms of which we are comprised are moving too. Each of these trillions of particles that compose our body consist of tightly packed bundles of neutrons and protons surrounded by a rapidly moving crowd of electrons. Existence itself is motion. The wisdom of Basho's practice of pilgrimage is to seize this moving reality and then use it to seek enlightenment. For the Buddhist, this means something particular, an understanding of the transitory and illusory nature of existence. Us Unitarian Universalists might take it in a slightly different tact, but either way, a helpful tactic within Basho's practice of pilgrimage is to seek inspiration, what we might call the divine, in the ordinary. This leads to sometimes humorous results in his haikus. Consider this one. Bitten by fleas and lice, I slept in bed. A horse urinating all the time close to my pillow. Such a poem suggests that when life is viewed as a pilgrimage, every experience has religious potential. For most of us, that is probably difficult to imagine. But we can learn from every interaction we have and everything we encounter. Pain or joy, success or failure, the extraordinary or the banal, each moment and each experience in our lives contains within it a kernel to reflect upon. It all depends on what approach you take and how open you are to exploring your life. Take something ordinary like cooking. Within the act of preparing food, there is an opportunity to learn about the ingredients themselves, the chemical processes which we use to prepare foods, and the social dynamics around eating. This lemon, for instance, offers us a way to reflect upon the chains of dependency that comprise our lives. The fruit came from someplace other than Massachusetts. It was picked by hands besides mine and transported to the grocery store by many people. It is derived from countless generations of cultivation. The lemon allows us to think about the whole structure of our civilization and the dependent reality of human existence. For without food, we would cease to be. Such reflective wisdom might run counter to Basho's own spiritual tendency. He wrote, "Whatever such a mind sees is a flower, and whatever such a mind dreams of is the moon. It is only a barbarous mind that sees other than the flower, merely an animal mind that dreams of other than the moon." But then again, perhaps not. The contemporary Buddhist Thich Nhat Hanh has written an elegant meditation entitled Interbeing. In it, he claims, "We can say that everything is here within this sheet of paper. We cannot point to one thing that is not here. Time, space, the earth, the rain, the minerals and the soil, the sunshine, the river, the heat. Everything coexists in this sheet of paper. Suppose we try to return one of the elements to its source. Suppose we try to return the sunshine. Do you think that this sheet of paper will be possible? Not without the sunshine can it be. The fact is that the sheet of paper is made up of only non-paper elements. And if we return these non-paper elements to their source, then there can be no paper at all. And without non-paper elements like mind, sunshine, and so on, there will be no paper. As thin as a sheet of paper is, it contains everything in the universe in it." The religious quest is partially about reaching the state of awareness about interconnection. certainly speaks to the seventh principle of our own Unitarian Universalist Association, respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. The question is not, is such an understanding one of our goals as a religious people? We can find such a goal attested to in many of the world's religious traditions. Rather, the question is, how do we begin to reach such a goal? One consistent answer has been to practice asceticism and shed attachments to individual material things. At the beginning of The Narrow Road to the Interior, Basho notes that before beginning his journey, he sold his house. With this action, then everything and everywhere became potentially his home. Rather than fixing his home as some place in particular, it became wherever he was. As he writes, "I felt quite at home, as if it were mine, sleeping lazily in this house of fresh air." Similar advice for seeking the religious experience can be found elsewhere. In Luke, Mark, Matthew, there's a story about Jesus giving advice to a young rich man. Many of you remember some version of the text. In Matthew, it reads, "If you wish to be perfect, go, sell your possessions and give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." In our tradition, the life of Henry David Thoreau offers a slightly different example. Thoreau was a kind of aesthetic. A resident of nearby Concord, he went to Walden Pond to try to live, as he wrote, "alone in the woods, in a house which I built myself, living by the labor of my hands only." His famous book, reflecting on his experiences, is filled with his scorn for the material conveniences of civilization. The clear implication throughout is that such goods inhibit a life of reflection. I have been thinking about such advice for the last 2.5 years since my wife and I sold our house in Ohio and moved to Massachusetts. Our living space is much smaller than it used to be. We've had to get rid of a lot of things that we've accumulated over the years. In the process, I've been thinking about my relationship to material goods. How much do they really matter? How many provide nothing more than a brief distraction and then sit on a shelf collecting dust? What do I really need in life? Again, turning to Basho, I find some useful advice. For at the start of his journey, he disposes of some, but not all, of his material goods. He writes, "The load I carried consisted of a paper coat to keep me warm at night, a light cotton gown to wear after the bath, scanty protection against the rain, writing equipment, and gifts from certain friends of mine." Even if we choose to take the route of the spiritual aesthetic, some things remain essential. Any pilgrimage requires a certain amount of material comfort to succeed. For even with his aesthetic tendencies, Basho was not found wandering the countryside naked. To journey through the life, material goods are, to some extent, necessary. As Thich Nhat Hanh would say, we inter-are with them. That is not to say we are dependent upon fancy sports cars for our existence, but we all need food, shelter, and clothing. The trick is to figure out what we need and what we want. And it is worth remembering that even if we try to walk life's paths alone, we are never really completely independent. Reading The Narrow Road to the Interior, one finds that Basho traveled in the company of others. Some of the haikus he records do not even originate with him. This one, for instance, comes from one of his companions, a monk named Sora. "Rid of my hair, I came to Mount Kurokami on the day we put on clean summer clothes." With that observation, I think of my own path to Basho. It began in elementary school, wound its way through my college years, and helped deliver me here. Along the way, I have had companions, not the least of whom is my wife, whom I discovered when I picked up my copy of Basho had peppered it with her own commentary. Another reminder that the journey we take may be our own, but we do not take it, but we take it in the company of others. We all receive help on our individual paths, whether we are cognizant of it or not. And if we look at the practice of pilgrimage closely, we discover buried within it are justice questions. What is necessary for each of us on our journey? How much do we all need? Can we have too much, so much that it prevents us from ever seeing what is really there? What obligations do we have to those who we travel with? Such questions are their own reminder that when we see things as we are, there is a certain richness that opens up. It's like the form of the haiku itself. The poem appears simple, but hides a wealth just below the surface. As another translation of Basho's frog poem reads, pond, frog, plop. May we, like Basho, travel with life blessed with companions and a religious community that helps us to see things as they are. Amen and blessed be.